He came eating and drinking. A look inside the meals of Jesus in the Gospel of Luke.
All right, I'm in Luke chapter 22. Luke chapter 22, and we're going through this series, He Came Eating and Drinking. If you were here at the end of the summer, you might have been here for the beginning of this series. Some of you have been around the whole summer. Some of you are coming back, and this is new to you, and some of you are just completely new. So let me give you just kind of catch you up to speed on what we're doing and why we're doing it. We have two more weeks in this series. And then after this, here's where we're going to go. I've got 2 weeks to kind of cast vision for the fall, and then after those 2 weeks, I am going to, we're going to work on a series in 1 John called A Letter for You. And it's just very practical insight in the Christian life. The man who wrote the book of John is one of Jesus' best friends. His name is John, right? So Pastor John, he's getting old, and he wants to write a letter to young believers and to stay faithful. And so he gives just a lot of practical wisdom. So it's a letter to you from Pastor John, who's in his old age. And so we love that. We think there's a lot of just really good things in there for us. We're going to spend the whole fall in the Gospel according to John. I'm really looking forward to doing that. Where we are now is wrapping up the series He Came Eating and Drinking, which is essentially a look at the meals of Jesus with sinners in the Gospel according to Luke. Luke records a lot of meal times with Jesus and lessons that we can learn as Jesus sat down and had meals with people. So we're doing the same thing. What are the lessons that he's teaching us? Last week, we started here in Luke 22, and Jesus instructs us on something we called a sacramental meal called communion. And so I won't take the time to rehash all that. You can stream that. I think you can download the sermon online. Listen to that if you need to catch up. But this is sort of part two of that dinner conversation. And here's what's going to happen. The conversation is going to start at one point where Jesus just pledged his body and his blood, his very soul to his disciples. He's just pledged that to them. And then he gives them this like really sober warning. And then they have this long conversation that ends up in a completely different place. In a place where they're like, how in the world did we end up here? And then Jesus takes that as an opportunity to teach a lesson. And that's why I broke it up into multiple parts. But have you ever been there? Right? Have you ever been in a place where you're having a conversation with somebody and sometimes it gets really heated and really dramatic and then you pause and stop and you think to yourself, how in the world did we get here from where we started? Have you ever done that? Most of us have at some point in our lives. Now, for me, it's not as much doing that with conversation, but since we're all here publicly, I'm going to make a confession. I am a horrible driver, okay? Horrible. If you've ridden in a car with me, you know this. I do not multitask very well. I can do one thing at a time, and I do it kind of average. So if you've been in a car with me, you know I'm a terrible driver. And here's an instance of that where I wish I could say it was the only time it happened, but it's like one of three or four. But I'm taking a trip from Asheville, North Carolina, down to Orlando, Florida. And I've got a guy in the car with me that I didn't know that well. We were kind of like, we met out mountain biking. He was going to Florida with me, and so we're getting to know one another. And now the way you get to Orlando, Florida from Asheville, North Carolina is that you get on Interstate 26 and you head south. And after you get just past Columbia, you take a right and then you head south, okay? So we're in the car and we're driving and we're chatting. And then all of a sudden, like as I'm driving and we're talking, I noticed that right in front of me was one of the most glorious things I'd seen in a long time. It was the Cooper River Bridge. And I'm just, so I see it, and I just start going on about, that's the Cooper River Bridge. I haven't seen it finished yet. Now, here's why I hadn't seen it finished yet. I had just moved to North Carolina. I'd been there for just about 3 or 4 months, and they had been working on this. And so the transition from South Carolina, where I was living, up to Asheville, North Carolina, was about a 6 to 8 month period, and so I wasn't making trips. Now, before that period, I was making trips. I was making a lot of trips from upstate South Carolina down to the coast. As I spent a lot of time, we would spend multiple weekends in a month down there hanging out at the beach, right? And I know you guys are jealous because you didn't have that opportunity. Some of you are like, I did all the time. Well, most of us that are from Cincinnati know how we don't have nice beaches around. But when I lived in South Carolina, it was 2.5 hours. So I could get up literally in the morning, think, what do you want to do today? Hey, let's go to the beach. by lunch, we're at the beach and we're hanging out there all the time. So I did that a lot, and they were building the Cooper River Bridge, which connected the city of Charleston to Mount Pleasant, Isle of Palms. Beautiful, beautiful beaches. All right. If you're ever looking for a place to go, do not go to Myrtle Beach. That place is an armpit. Go to Charleston, Isle of Palms, right? Go to Hilton Head. Some of you are like, I love Myrtle Beach. I'm sorry, okay? Go to Charleston. I promise you will not regret it. Great city, tons of cool things to do. So we're driving along. I see the Cooper River Bridge. I'm going on and on about how cool it is and how great it looks and how the old bridge always was rickety and made me feel uncomfortable. And then all of a sudden I stopped and thought to myself, what in the world are we doing in Charleston, South Carolina, right? I had missed my turn by an hour and a half, okay? And that's not an isolated incident. I missed a Mother's Day lunch once because I was flapping my yap or talking in the car when I should have made a right-hand turn. And for whatever reason, it seems to be right-handed turns, right? Coming back from Raleigh, I ended up in Charlotte when I was heading back to Asheville. So I do this. I'm a terrible driver, and I end up in places that I stop and think, how in the world did we get here from where we started? And so that happens when I'm driving. It happened conversationally for the disciples. Let's look at how it happens for them. Verse 21 of Luke 22. But behold, the hand of him who betrays me is with me on the table. That's Jesus speaking. He says in verse 22, for the Son of Man goes as it has been determined, but woe to that man by whom he is betrayed. And they began to question one another, which of them it could be who was going to do this. So the conversation starts with a very sobering discussion, doesn't it? I mean, Jesus is like, I'm offering myself up for you, but one of you, one of the 13 people sitting at the table, Jesus excluded, is going to betray Jesus. And that's where the conversation starts. Okay? Very sobering, very heavy, and they start asking questions like, is it going to be me? Am I going to be the one? Like, they start asking the question, am I going to be the one that betrays Jesus? And then a verse later, look at verse 24. A dispute also arose among them as to which of them was to be regarded as the greatest, right? And so it goes quickly into absurdity, doesn't it? Like, one of you is going to betray me. And they start, is it going to be me? Am I going to be the one that betrays Jesus? And before you know it, a dispute rises. So that it goes in from them questioning themselves to them arguing who was the best person at the table, right? Which one of us is going to be the greatest? And it probably, you know, they probably had to stop and ask the question, like, how in the world did we get here? It's such an absurd statement, especially when you're sitting with Jesus, right? There's 13 people at the table, and they're all asking, which one of us is the greatest? And it makes you kind of want to grab these men by the back of the neck and, like, knock them on the forehead and say, hey, dummy, you're sitting with Jesus, okay? So when you ask the question, when you're sitting with Jesus, of who is going to be the greatest, the answer is, it's not you, okay? It's not you. Right? And so if I were sitting there, hopefully I would have the senses to not get sucked into the argument, although I know my own heart, I know my propensity toward arrogance and being puffed up with pride. I'm probably leading the charge on that dummy discussion. But that's what they're doing there. So one of you is going to betray me, too. Which one of us is the greatest, Jesus? And here's what I love about Jesus. Jesus does not shame them at that moment, right? He's not like, well, which one of you is offering up his body and his blood? Right? He doesn't do that. Instead, he kind of engages the question that they're asking. Now, it's going to be one of the disciples who has betrayed Jesus. The first question they ask is, who's going to do this? And then they start into this question about who would be the greatest, and Jesus won't shame them. So pick it up in verse 25. He said to them, the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those in authority over them are called benefactors. But not so with you. Rather, let the greatest among you become as the youngest, and the leader as one who serves. For who is the greater, one who reclines at table or one who serves? Is it not the one who reclines at table? But I am among you as the one who serves. You are those who have stayed with me in my trials, and I assign to you, as my Father assigned to me, a kingdom that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. So Jesus doesn't shame them in their quest for greatness, right? Now he reminds them, my kingdom, right? My judgment, I will give that to you. But he doesn't shame them in their quest for greatness, but he also doesn't directly answer their question, because their question is, which one of us is going to be the greatest? And instead, he kind of holds it out there as a motivating factor for them to have a quest for true greatness. And he sets up a contrast, right? And he says, let me tell you about people who aren't in my kingdom, who don't follow me, who don't yield to me, who are not part of God's people. Let's talk about how they exercise greatness. They get places of authority and they rule it over people. And they do it to the point where they want to be seen as dispensers of goodness. That's what it means to be a benefactor, right? And so it's the Gentiles, it's the people that are far from God, it's the people that are not part of God's people, that are not in the kingdom of heaven, that when they establish greatness, they do it by gathering in power for themselves. Right? That's the illustration that he uses. So he contrasts his people with those people. And he says, that's not how I want my people to pursue greatness. Don't do it like that. And then he gives them an illustration. If you're sitting down at a table and there are people who are coming in and they're serving, which do you assume to be the greater people? And even in case they answer it incorrectly, right, they get a little bit of a streak of self-righteousness, like, well, of course, it's the ones that are serving the dinner. He says, no, isn't it the people that are sitting down and they're reclining? Those are the great ones. And then he says, but not my people. That's not how I came, right? I'm not the one reclining at the table. We do this all the time. We're still doing this in our culture, aren't we? We're still establishing who are the people who are great. We give them the authority. We take it away from the servants. When was the last time you were at a nice restaurant? Somebody's like, I never go to nice restaurants. All right. But if you were, right, you go in there and you look around and you start to watch who are the greatest. And it's usually the people that have the greatest service provided to them. They're in the private room, right? They have multiple servers. If you go in, you're just some scrub off the street, right? You're going to get Tina. She will be your server tonight. Right? You're not in the private room, but the people in the private room, the great ones, they have Tina and Joe and Bob, and in fact, Tina is ignoring you to make sure that those people have great service, right? Have you been in that? And you start to think, well, who is that? Who is that that's so great? And we start to pursue, I want to be like that person. I want to be like them. And Jesus is saying, but that's not how I came among you. I didn't come seeking to be served. That the Son of Man came to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. Remember the words that I just told you? This is my body. This is my blood. I'm offering up for you. That's the way that Jesus comes. That's the way that people in God's kingdom come. It's not those reclined at the table, but the servers who are the great ones. Now, I could stop here and park and just say, okay, so what does this mean for us when we do go out? And some of you are like, I never go out to eat. But, well, you will someday. And when you do, I want you to consider the posture of your heart toward the person who's serving you. What is the posture of your heart? I mean, you've just been given a little bit of authority. You've got somebody who comes out, Tina, and she says, I'm going to be serving you tonight. And now you get a chance to share with her your thoughts and desires. Here's what I would like. Here's what I want. But how do you treat her in those moments? Because Jesus, in that environment, is looking and saying, the ruler, the great one, is the one who's serving, not the one who's lording it over, not the one who's saying, if you do a good enough job, I'll give you a tip. I'm a great benefactor, right? I'm a wonderful human being. But so our posture toward those who serve us is key to what's going on in our hearts. And you get opportunities. If you don't go out to eat, you do sometimes. I know this because this is kind of the culture of our community. I know you go out and order coffee, right? Some of you don't, but most of you do. In fact, it's one of the things that we keep hearing about, the coffee snobbery at Missio Dei Church, right? And then here's what we've done. Like, we're trying to serve, we're trying to be a blessing to people, and so we bought a new, it's not a coffee maker, it's a coffee extractor, right? So coffee snobs, eat your heart out. There you go. We're going to be extracting coffee for you, right? And then I got the, I saw what we paid for this, and then I was shocked, okay? It's, for some of you, it's like, yeah, actually you got a really great deal on your coffee extractor, but the number that was assigned to it, it kind of shocked me. And I started thinking, okay, here's what this can become. This can become an opportunity to feed the selfish souls of our people, or it can be an opportunity to be a blessing to our people, right? Two people can be doing the exact same thing. One is worshiping, one is sinning. And so what this can become is every Sunday morning, people come in and they get their amazingly, wonderfully tasting, extracted coffee. They don't say boo to anybody. They come in here, they sit down, then they're evaluating the music and the sermon, and they're just going on critiquing and saying, this is what I want, because you've been given a little bit of authority. Or it can be an opportunity to show up early, to grab a cup of coffee, to sit down in the cafe and listen to somebody's story, hear them out, pray with them. We want the latter to happen, right? We want you to come in and serve one another. And then I'll probably hold this like as a threat. I know Jesus didn't shame his people when they made foolish conversation, but I'm not Jesus, so I will shame, right? And so I'll hold the threat over. You keep doing this, we're taking it away, right? That's the way I parent. That's the way I'm going to do this here, okay? Maybe it's not super fruitful, but that's the posture we're going to take. But do you see the difference? Do you see how we do this? When you go out and you order coffee, like, are you the guy that's complaining that it's not whipped right, that it's not made according to the right temperature, that it's not good enough for your lordship, and so you're going to withhold blessings and honor? You're no longer going to be a benefactor to the barista who withheld from you what you desired. Is that how we treat people? Because for many of us, we're like, yeah, that is exactly how I treat people. That's what's in my heart. And so it means something for how we encounter people in real life. So I want us to stop and think for just a moment. Like, how do we mess this up? Jesus doesn't say it's wrong to pursue greatness. Some of us do. Some of us are very apathetic, right? And so some of us, we hear this conversation about greatness and we think, well, that's a ridiculous thing. Human beings aren't designed to pursue greatness. But Jesus doesn't say that. Right? And so those of us that are apathetic and we're not pursuing greatness, we're just lowering the bar, we need kind of a wake-up call, because Jesus actually says, no, you want to pursue greatness. You just need to do it differently than you are. So the apathetic among us need to repent. But some of us pursue greatness at the expense of others. We go around as lords and benefactors, and we lord it over people that we're in charge and we have decisions that can be made. We focus so much on ourselves so that we can be looked upon as great, dispensing goodness from our greatness. And Jesus looks at this and he says, no, the best among us, the greatest among us, the leaders among us, they're to be the servants. That's what it means to be great, to serve, to give your life for others, to make others great. And Jesus commissions us to do this. And then he wants to send us out. And then he tells another, this is part of the story that I think is really good for us to kind of take note of. Verse 31. Jesus addresses, he singles one of the disciples out. He says, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan demanded to have you that he might sift you like wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned again, strengthen your brothers. Peter said to him, Lord, I am ready to go with you both to prison and to death. Jesus said, I tell you, Peter, the rooster will not crow this day until you deny three times that you know me. So Jesus gets heavy for a moment, right? He'd already changed the name of Peter. Peter's God-given name was Simon, then his Jesus God-given name was Peter. And Peter means rock. And when Peter is making great confession about who Jesus is, Jesus looks and says, you are the rock. But now, in the time of trial, he looks at him, he says, Simon. And he doesn't say it once, he says it twice, Simon. Right? You're going to have moments where you're weak, where you're not the rock, where in your attempt to serve, and though you think of yourself as Peter and bold, right? I'll go anywhere with you. I'll go to prison with you. I'll even go to the death with you. He thinks of himself as very strong. Jesus acknowledges you're going to feel strong, right, Peter? Peter, you're going to deny me three times. Even in your strength, you're going to deny me. And so Jesus is aware that as he sends us out as servants, because many of us are, we're here, right? We're like, okay, I need to be a good servant. If I'm going to honor God and love people, I need to serve well. And Jesus is going to send us out as servants, but we're going out in our own strength. And he wants to call attention to that. there's some things that are going to happen as we go out in our own strength. First thing is that we're going to feel isolated. He calls out Peter. He doesn't call out the disciples generally. He calls out Peter. And he says, Simon, Simon. And there are times when you're going to go out and you're going to feel like you're all alone. You're going to feel like when you step out in faith to serve God, to make these bold and daring claims, that you're out there completely alone. You're going to feel isolated. You're going to feel like nobody knows, nobody cares. Sometimes it's true, right? It's not just imagined, but there is isolation when it comes to servant leadership. You step up and you say, I've got the emotional courage to make this decision. People are not going to like it. You're going to feel isolated. Not only are you going to feel isolated, you're going to feel intimidated. The task, right? Prison, death. These things seem overwhelming to us. And so part of our denial comes from a not just an isolation, but an intimidation. I'm afraid of what's going to happen to me. And Peter was so afraid of it that it took a little slave girl who really had no power to get him to deny Jesus. And so it's not always the things that are really truly intimidating, but sometimes the things that just seem intimidating that get us to shut down and deny Christ. And so not only are we isolated, not only are we intimidated, there's also times when we struggle with insincerity. And we stop and we ask the question, like, is this real? Because I seem like the only one, and what I'm up against seems overwhelming, and I'm not sure I really buy this. I'm not sure, I'm fully sold out for this idea. Man, so there are some compelling arguments against where I'm coming from. And so you're going to feel like you're insincere and you're just kind of going through the motions. And I'll say this, your doubt and your struggle is not a lack of faith. I know sometimes that's what we set up as the antithesis of faith, that it's doubt and that it's struggle. Jesus doesn't do that. He kind of affirms that that's going to happen. Like, you're going to go out. You're going to feel isolated. You're going to feel intimidated. You're going to feel insincere. That's going to happen. And here's the thing. Insincerity, that is not a lack of faith. Sometimes it's the most faithful thing you can do. Because what you're doing is you're saying, Lord, I'm struggling right now. I believe that this is what you want, but I'm not seeing it. And I'm really struggling. I'd love to see you prove to me that this is the case, right? That's a very faithful thing. The opposite of faith is not doubt. The opposite of faith is unbelief. When you're saying, no, Jesus, you're not good. No, I will not do this. No, I will not embrace you in that way. And so even though you're facing isolation, intimidation, and insincerity, Jesus gives us good news. What does he say? I'm praying for you. Satan has desired to sift you like wheat, to separate you out, to make your faith fail, but I am praying for you. So Jesus is not saying your relationship with me and with God's people is dependent on how well you serve. He says, I'm the servant and I'm praying for you. And that becomes good news, doesn't it? We need Jesus praying for us. Because we will be isolated, we will be intimidated, we will feel insincere, and we need to know that Jesus has our back. And Jesus, that's the promise that he's making. I've got your back on this. I'm praying for you that your faith won't fail. You're going to struggle with this, but when you return, my expectation doesn't drop. He's not saying, I hope you fail. He's saying, I think you probably will. And so I'm praying for you. And when the strength comes back, when you turn again, strengthen the brothers. Serve them, right? So you serve out of the strength that Jesus provides. Jesus is the great servant. This is where Christianity begins. That's where it begins, that Jesus lays his life down for you, and he's serving you, and he's praying for you. That's great news, isn't it? It's not dependent on you and your service and your ability. You, by serving, are just showing you believe that Jesus is doing that for you. You believe the promises, and we're saved by faith. And it becomes such good news that we get to declare that to others. Jesus is praying for us that we might be empowered to serve faithfully. So, what does it look like played out? And this is where I'm going to park. I'm going to spend a little bit of time here because I want this to become very tangible. And I've received, this should be a very encouraging message for you. I hope I can paint a picture where you're like, okay, I can do this, okay? Number one, I've got 4 points. Number one, let Jesus serve you. Let him serve you. All right, like I said, this is where Christianity begins. And for so many of us, we like the idea of Jesus. We like the person of Jesus. We like the teachings of Jesus. We like the examples of Jesus. But what we don't like is a Jesus who offers himself up for me and prays for me. Am I right? You men, like, this is our struggle, isn't it? I can be like Jesus. I will follow him. I will go to prison and to death for him. And Jesus is saying, why would you do that? I'm not asking you to do that. You don't have to do that for me, right? Peter, sit back down, okay? You're going to probably end up denying me if that's the road you go down, right? So men especially, right? And ladies too, make this personal. Let Jesus serve you. Let him offer his life for you. Let him pray for you. Admit your weaknesses and lead out of that, where you're not seeking greatness in worldly ways, where you can do it and you're a lord and a benefactor. But when you lead from need and want. And Jesus says, let me serve you in that way. Last Sunday night, we gathered our elder candidates together for a training session. We have three men that are seeking to become elders here. It's a lengthy process. I'm always trying to evaluate how do we make it tough enough that not every dude that says, hey, I want to be a pastor can just walk into it, and we're careless with the men that we put, that we see that God his hand is on them. And so we're trying to balance like the difficulty with like making it accessible. And so we're always wrestling through that. We want to train the men well who have stepped up into that position. But we finished up our training time and started sharing my heart and said, let's pray for one another. And that time, from that moment, I saw men open up and say, here's where I'm struggling. And some of them had like personal issues with me and said, here's where I'm struggling with you, where you're disappointing me. And I just need to say this. And so they opened up and they shared their vulnerability. They shared with me their need for Jesus. They shared with me how I need to open up to them more on my need for Jesus. And I thought, this is great. This is glory. This is the way the church is led, right? It's led by men who aren't lords and benefactors. It's led by men who say, we need Jesus. And we need Jesus to serve us, and we need Jesus praying for us. And I'm not saying like we make a complete train wreck out of our lives, but we're men who are constantly leading people to need Jesus. And that's such a glorious place to be. That's the environment that God is creating here for his people. And it's so thrilling. Like, those are the men I want to lock arms with and say, yes, let's do this together. And so when we call like men to leadership, that's what we're talking about. I'm not talking about like the WWF, you know, promotion that we saw up here, act like men, be strong, okay? I was waiting for at the end of that video for pyrotechnics to go off, right? That's why I'm glad that Justin came up here, like, Missio Nature, right? That's kind of what you feel like. And there's goodness in that, right? We need our backbones firmed up, but we need it firmed up in a way that shows us our brokenness and our need for Jesus. We need him to serve us and to pray for us, so let him serve you. If you haven't stopped and allowed Jesus to serve you, to offer up himself for you, to pray for you, you're not even a Christian. This is where Christianity begins. If you're constantly trying to impress God and impress people and establish a right standing, you're not even a Christian. Christianity begins when Jesus serves his people. He came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. That's where it begins. So let Jesus serve you. Secondly, pursue godly greatness. Pursue godly greatness. Don't settle for apathy. Don't settle for nothingness. Don't lower the bar and say, Jesus doesn't expect anything from me. He doesn't do that, right? He doesn't look at Peter and say, you're going to struggle here. Satan has desired to sift you, to let you be apathetic, to walk out on the faith, and to give up on the brothers. So go ahead and just move in back home with mommy and play video games for the rest of your life. He says, no, I'm praying for you that you would be empowered to strengthen the brothers, to raise the bar, to encourage men, to get the backbone, right? Now the pyrotechnics are going off, right? That Jesus is praying for us. That gives us confidence. That gives us boldness. But we need to pursue godly greatness. Don't pursue it like the Gentiles who want to lord over people and see themselves as dispensers of good things, the benefactors, but pursue service toward people. The godly among us are the ones who serve. Pursue that. Pursue that greatness. It's a good thing. Don't be apathetic. Thirdly, seek greatness in and for others. seek greatness in and for others. Simply put, be a servant. Be a servant, right? When you return, strengthen the brothers. Give yourselves away. And so I want to just kind of address a few of this in light of this. Many of us are single in here. And I want you to stop and start to think about, okay, what are the things that caused me to drift from service in my singleness? And having had multiple conversations with many of you, not just like in the last year, but throughout the years, one of the things that I discovered that becomes a drift factor for singles is a victim mentality. This idea that somebody's holding out on you. And a lot of times that someone is God. And so you start maneuvering and manipulating so that God would give you what you want. And what you're doing in that is you are expressing leadership like those who don't know God. And so you start posturing yourself, you start doing, if I do this, then God will give me what I need, so then I can be a distributor of good things to others. Don't do that. Seek Jesus. And here's the thing. Some of you have heard, if you seek Jesus, then he'll give you what you want. He might not, right? He really might not. Because you don't seek him to get what you want. That's the wrong way of pursuing greatness. That's not pursuing greatness. That's pursuing selfishness. And you're still being a lord and a benefactor. And that's not what people, God's people are to do. Not so with you. Seek serving people. And so if you're single, protect sexual purity. Serve, if God brings you a spouse, serve that spouse now by protecting you. Serve. And another way you can do it, don't look at those who are married and have children, particularly if they're married, have been married for about 13 years and have about 4 kids, right? Don't see us as the enemy. See us as an opportunity for you to be a blessing from God, to bless us, serve us. And I'm not just begging for service, but here's the thing. In our mission group, we've got a young man who is a single guy. I've never once heard him complain. He may complain all the time, but I've never heard him complain about being single. And every time he comes to my home, he is a joy to have because he serves my family and my children. In fact, just the other day, there was a picture on Facebook posted on him about him with him in it. And I'm showing my son Kai because anytime I talk about Michael, they get all excited. And so I show Kai a picture of Michael at Kings Island riding a ride. I'm like, hey, Kai, here's your buddy Michael riding a ride. And Rain's at the other end of the couch. She hears this and she says, no, no, no. He's not Kai's buddy. He's my buddy. I want to see the picture. And like, you don't know what that does to a father's soul when the men and women that you bring into your home include your kids as part of the community. But he does that. I've never heard him complain about being single or not having. He looks and he says, no, this family will be my family, and I will serve them, and I will tell those kids about Jesus, and I will do whatever I can to relieve the burden of these parents who are with these children all the time. So don't see yourselves as victim. That will cause you to drift. Instead, see yourself as God's appointee to be of service to those who might be married and might have children. Good? Married couples. How are you doing with this? Is your husband, is your wife there to make your life nice? And one of the number one things I talk about in ministry is marital conflict. And 9 times out of 10, the reason that there's marriage conflict is because one or both, usually both, but and then one even predominantly, is coming trying to fix the other person so that they can have things nice, right? And so a spouse becomes, in our life, and our culture just feeds this, an opportunity for us to become lords and benefactors, right? I marry you because I love you, and you do something for me. And the Christian view of marriage is that God brings somebody that's opposite and complementary to you to draw out of the wicked things in your heart that are in there, to get you outside of yourself, serving, looking out for the needs of another human being in a way that you won't do with anybody else. That's the Christian picture of marriage. So you are God's appointed servant to another person. And God is using that other person to draw out of your things, wicked things that are in your heart that need to be brought out and dealt with and gospeled. God did not bring you into somebody's life so that you could be the tool to improve them. But we don't believe that. Because we're the Lord, we're the benefactor, we're dispensing good things. If you would just listen to my point of view, this would be great. And instead, it needs to be, how can I serve you? What? How do you feel loved? How do you feel served? A lot of our miscommunication comes in just that issue, that your spouse feels loved in a certain way, you feel loved in another way. You're trying to express love to your spouse in a way that you would feel loved, but they don't feel loved. They don't feel heard. They don't feel journeyed with. They feel isolated, intimidated, and insincere. And so you're there to serve your spouse. You're there to listen to your spouse. You're there to do things that you don't feel like doing for the betterment of somebody else, because God calls us to seek the greatness of others. And that's what marriage is. Parents, you get to deal with this on a daily basis, don't you? Mamas, you realize that your bodies are designed as temples of service, right? I mean, they're physically designed to serve children, right? They're physically designed to serve in other ways. But primarily, they're physically, you're designed to be a temple of service for other human beings. I mean, God stamped that on women. And then men are supposed to take a visual cue from that, because we're very visually driven. We're supposed to say, oh, God designed my wife to serve our kids. Maybe I should come alongside of her and help her with that service to our kids. I mean, it's written into the way that we're designed. And God is saying, I've given you these children not to make your life easy, but so that you will serve them and make them great. God is constantly, in grace, giving us opportunities to make much of others, to seek greatness. And what we do all the time is we take those opportunities and we say, how can I make this great for me? Right? And so dads that have kids, like I've got a 9-year-old and a 7-year-old, and I've introduced them lately to mowing the grass. And there's a sinful way to introduce them, and there's a godly, worshipful way to introduce them. The sinful way is, hey, the game starts at noon. I need to get the grass cut. Boys, get your shoes on. Get outside. We're going to work, right? The godly way is to say, I need to teach my boys about responsibility and about stewardship and about beautification, because God has designed us to make things good and beautiful. And so I need help with this, and I want them to come alongside of me, and I'm going to have an opportunity to now say, hey, job well done, to build into them, to seek the greatness of them. Now, confession, I've done both, okay? There are times when I'm like, all right, I've got this at this time. Boys, get your shoes on. Let's go. And then there are times where I'm able to say, hey, let me show you how this works. Let me show you what it means to take responsibility, to cultivate. Let me show you what it's like to be masculine. I'll teach you how to start the lawnmower, right? Kai gets all excited about that. But and then when he's done, even though he can't, for whatever reason, walk in a straight line, right? And I'm still puzzled by how children can't do this, but it's a zigzaggy line. But I get done, and I could bring that up. Instead, I'll just do it publicly and shame my children, right? But when he's done, and I'm genuinely thankful for it, I look at him and say, buddy, great job. Thank you. Do you know how much that helped Daddy? Do you know how much that served Daddy? Do you know how much time that saved for Daddy that now we can play and have fun? Thank you. So we're given these opportunities to seek the greatness of others. And my kids, they light up at that. Right? They don't light up so much at, hey, I need help, I'm doing all the work, and you kids are ungrateful. But they really light up when I say, hey, you want to come do this? You want to help Daddy with this? Okay, I know you don't want to, but I need you to. So come on out, and then when they're done, great job. Thank you so much. I really needed your help. Church, don't settle for others to do all the service for you. One of our hopes at Missio, I'll introduce it this way. There are two offices in the church, right? There's elders and pastors. Right? Their job is to shepherd the people, to feed them, to serve them by teaching them the word of God, to pray for them, to help establish, like, where is the Lord taking us, that sort of thing. That's one office. The other office is deacon. And do you know what the term deacon means? It means table servant. So the two offices, the one, you're serving people by feeding them. The other is you're taking care of the tables. You're meeting physical needs. Our desire at Missio is for all of our members to seek a level of leadership as a deacon. We want you to seek to serve. What we don't want is people that come in and expect everybody else to do the work and then complain about what's not being done. Where you walk in, you say, you know what you really need, what they really need to do. We don't want it to be an us-them. We want it to be a we-us. You know what we could do? You know what we should do? You know what I would like to do? And then we're going to give you an opportunity to do it. But we want all of our members to seek to serve. There's a lot that needs to be done. There's a lot of lives, and there's great opportunities for us to make much of Jesus' kingdom in the lives of the people around us, but it won't happen if we come in and we believe that there are two offices, and their job is to serve, and their job is to serve me and my needs. And so again, we need to be careful with this coffee thing, right? Some of you are like, I don't even drink coffee, okay? But that's what we want to see. We want to see you come in, serve people, sit down with them, listen to their stories. Don't just come in, get your religious goods, have a seat, sing some songs, and then go out of here and complain, he went too long, right? I didn't really understand this story. The music was flat. It was too loud, right? You see the difference. You see the difference. If it is too loud, say, hey, I need to help with the soundboard. Maybe I can help there. Maybe I can serve and make this a more enjoyable experience for everybody. And then finally, our church for the city. Cincinnati already is the greatest city on the planet. Am I right? Is that great? Yes. Yes. It really is. I mean, I've tried to get away from here for 15 years. I was away from Cincinnati. I lived in other towns, and nothing compares to Cincinnati, to the beauty of the culture of Cincinnati. My desire is to see Cincinnati be a great city, and it's a great opportunity. I mean, my wife and I, we were talking about doing church planting in cities like Cape Town, South Africa, and when plans for that fell through, we were talking about planting a church in Brooklyn, and then the Lord, like, he drew us back home to the place that made us. And he said, I want you to serve here and make this city great. Let me tell you about the opportunities you have here. Cincinnati was settled by East Coast German immigrants, right? So there's a strong German Catholic feel to the architecture and to the culture and the society around Cincinnati. But it left a lot of the East Coast arrogance, right? And if you're from the East Coast, you know what I'm talking about, right? I don't even have to apologize. You're like, yeah, we are. Okay, so that was left, and we're situated in the Midwest. Strong work ethic, right? And kind of a, like, we have a high sense of justice, a high sense of morality, a high sense of you've got to work hard. That comes from our Midwestern location. And then it's butt up against this crazy, weird Southern Appalachian culture, right? And if you're from north of the Mason-Dixon, you'll say Appalachian. If you're from south of the Mason-Dixon and you live in Appalachia, it's Appalachia. Right? The A is not long, it's short, Appalachia. But all these three cultures converge in Cincinnati, and there's no place like it on earth, right? Nobody else has the Reds. Nobody else has the Bengals. Some of you are like, nobody else wants the Bengals. Oh yeah, you will this year. You will this year, right? They're looking great. But we want to see these things. Like, we want to see Cincinnati great. We want people, when they think about Cincinnati, to say, oh, that's where the kingdom of God is breaking forth. That's where church communities get along and they lock arms for service and they do things together and they're not territorial and they're saying, how can we help you? How can we bless you? That's a city that serves one another. That's what we want to see. We want to be a church like that. So that's what we want to plant all throughout Cincinnati. And then finally, not just seeking greatness in and for others, but fourthly, expressing gratitude. Saying thank you. Now, no, some of us just do what we do for the thank you, and that's your reward, and that's all you'll get, but it's good fuel for the soul to be thanked, isn't it? To get up, and it's good for our souls to be the ones expressing thanksgiving. It takes a tremendous amount of work for Missio Dei to happen. And so last week, I know we had the leadership appreciation picnic where we had a legendary football game, and I shared with everybody that Cliff Zimmer is, like, he is the dark horse of two-hand touch football. So if you're ever playing two-hand touch, you see Cliff, get him on your team, right? He will make the game-changing play, I promise, right? But we had that just to say thank you to all of our leaders. And I want to say thank you again, because you can never say thank you enough. So if you see people that are involved in ministry around this building, go up to them and say thank you. And it was a glorious thing. I don't know if you noticed, but if you came in after the 9 o'clock, like, people were in a good mood. I can't tell you how many people came up to me and said, thank you for this, thank you for this, thank you for this. How many conversations I overheard people saying, hey, thank you, thank you, thank you. Like, I want us to get sick of the word thank you. All right? Wouldn't that be a glorious thing? Let me tell you about the people that are serving. You've got our hospitality coordinators who show up early. Some of them cook breakfast for our worship teams so that we don't have to rush out of the house. We get to sit here and enjoy a meal together. They print out bulletins. They're there to hand them out to you. They brew coffee. They make sure the coffee area is clean. They check the bathrooms. I mean, there's a lot of work that goes into that. So when you see somebody with the badge hanging there, handing you, say thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Our children's workers, they get up early. They come here. They're working so that the children aren't pulling each other's hair and throwing basketballs in one another's faces, right? They're there to clean up dirty diapers, to clean up spilled puke. I mean, they're there to serve our kids so that our kids might come in and think, hey, this is an environment where people are, they're here to love me. They're here to point me to something great, not to harm me. So say thank you to them as you're dropping off your children or picking them up. Our ushers, they're here, they wander the building. Some of you are new to this, and you're driving into a shady part of Cincinnati, and you're driving into a shady building, right? And so if you walked in and you saw a guy with a t-shirt that said security, many of you are going to have a conniption and leave, right? But it says usher. Now, little secret here, that's security, okay? They're wandering the halls during the gathering, making sure things are safe, because we are in a shady neighborhood, and our kids are kind of spread out. And so they're making sure, they're kind of putting their lives in danger. I know we've never had an incident, but it could happen. That they're the ones that are on the front lines. So say thank you. They're trying to create an environment where we can listen to the gospel preached in an undistracted fashion. Say thank you to those men that do that. Our sound people, they work hard to make sure the slides are up at the right time, to make sure that the music is the right volume. Say thank you to them. Our lead worshipers and our musicians, we have four bands that have to coordinate various schedules to get all these musicians up here so that we can lead in singing the gospel. Let's say thank you to them. Mission group leaders, they pour their lives out for people, right? Like Deacon Justin said earlier, we do life in community here. And our mission group leaders are the backbone of that community. They study the text. They study the notes that I send them so that they can discuss this intelligibly. They open up their homes, right? And some of them don't like to do that. They deal with spilled drinks and broken things so that the gospel can go out. And they don't get paid for it. And so we want to say thank you to them. Our art walk coordinators and our museum curator works really hard to establish good relationships with people in the building so that we can tell the message, the gospel, the hope of Jesus as hundreds of people come in to look at art. And they want to make the gallery look nice, and they're always asking, how can we improve this? Let's say thank you to them. Our facilities workers who work tirelessly to keep this place clean. You guys are kind of a dirty crowd. I'm amazed at how much of a mess we make at communion, right? You'd think you could break a piece off and like put it in your mouth, but I'm guilty of this as well. Like, we break it off and then we drag crumbs all throughout here, right? And so between gatherings and after gatherings, they're coming in, they're cleaning up, they're wiping off. I mean, there's a lot of work that goes into that. Our ladies leaders, our creative teams, I mean, it's just on and on and on. This is not happening because I'm such a great person. This is happening because the people of God are coming together, serving one another, seeking greatness in others, wanting to see the gospel of the kingdom go out from here. And Jesus looks at all this and he says, that's greatness. That's greatness. And that's what we want to be a part of. That's what I want you to be a part of. I love you. I'm glad you're here. I want to give you a minute to just kind of reflect and ask the question, all right, who do I need to serve and to whom do I need to say thank you? I want you to reflect on that. There'll be some folks to pray with you in the back. And then after you've kind of wrestled through that, it starts with Christ. And so you're going to come forward and you're going to partake of Jesus by faith. Let Jesus serve you. And when you come forward in communion, that's what you're saying. You're saying, I'm letting Jesus serve me. I'm letting his body be broken for me, his blood to be poured out for me, that I might have power to serve people. If you have an aversion to wine or to our bread because of diet or conscience, we have gluten-free bread and grape juice in the bowl. You're welcome to partake of communion that way. And then finally, we're going to serve one another by singing to one another. Songs and hymns and spiritual songs, making melody in your heart to God, but singing to one another, serving one another in that way. I love you guys. I'm glad you're here. Let's pray, and then we'll serve. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for the encouragement of your word. Thank you that it's not dependent on my service, but on yours. Thank you that you are in heaven praying for your people right now. And so as we begin to meditate, our prayers are simply joining your prayers, and the Father's hearing us, and the Spirit is being poured out on us. God, make us servants. Help us to participate in what you're doing. In the name of the Father, Son, and Spirit, amen.